Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Bringing together some 115 photographs from across four decades of the artist's career, Sally Mann, A Thousand Crossings, offers both a sweeping overview of her achievement and a focused exploration of the continuing influence of the American South on her work. For a public symposium held on April 14, 2018, in conjunction with the exhibition, Maurice Wallace argues for sound as a neglected consideration in photographic criticism. Every photograph, insofar as photography is defined by its soundless condition, represses the sound necessarily attending to the picture-taking event. Examining the life of Martin Luther King Jr. in pictures, especially those that capture him in the art of speech-making or preaching, Wallace vividly demonstrates how photographs record sound's memory, if not its audibility. Further, Wallace suggests a set of sounds, black sounds, that not only haunt some of man's compelling photographs, but also belong to the very soundscape that shaped King's own resonantly remembered voice. This program is made possible by the James D. and Catherine K. Steele Fund for Photography.
It is now commonly said, not unbelievably, that Frederick Douglass, black abolitionist and author, was the most photographed American of the 19th century. By Stauffer, Todd, and Bernier's accounting, Douglass sat for an estimated 160 portraits, while Lincoln, by their best count, had 126 portraits made. Between Douglass's 160 distinct photographic posings and Lincoln's 126, General George Custer, Lakota Chief Red Cloud, and the inimitable Democrat Walt Whitman appeared in 155, 128, and 127 portraits, respectively. That Douglass specifically was so profoundly charmed by photography's 19th century allure as to exceed all others in number and degree of photo indulgences may well have indexed the confidence of many an ex-slave in the social power of photography to effect, as Laura Wexler has posited, quote, an image of a new birth of justice by black inclusion in American society. Under this logic, it comes as no surprise that a century later, another black freedom fighter seeking a second image of a new birth of racial justice with all the Protestant baggage attached to that turn of phrase would contend for the title formerly enjoyed by Douglass. Anymore, it is near impossible to avoid the dozen or more books, hardback and softcover, picturing galleries of portraits and journalistic photographs taken of the short life and career of Martin Luther King Jr. They are, it seems, everywhere, for now. Photographs of King, 50 years past his death, abound. King is as visible in the checkout lane at Wegmans Food Market in Charlottesville, or the newsstand at Terminal B in Reagan National Airport, as he is more formally and in a more considered context in the second floor gallery space of the New York Historical Society. Public depots of popular American visual culture and consumption, these are the new geographies of Martin Luther King Jr.'s amplified visibility in photographs. Here, if we care to look, we are the everyday or weekend witnesses of America's belatedly beloved civil rights rock star, holding forth against Southern segregationism, forcefully declaiming the high ideals of democracy, praying in the public square, preaching, marching, musing, or stiffly posing for the professional portrait. Here, if we care to listen, a new noisiness may be heard above the din of co-workers chatting it up in aisle 3, gate change announcements over the public address system, an airy museum whispering. This new noisiness, however, issues not from disembodied announcements overhead or the ordinary speech of everyday social intercourse, but from nothing other than a repressed property in King's photographs themselves. Put another way, and somewhat against reason, I admit, I want to suggest that it is not King's visual form or physical comportment alone we are made to see in the most iconic pictures of him which circulate in our public culture. Rather, I contend that we are made to see his sound as well. By this, I mean to imply in exactly these terms that synesthetic experience the amazing Roy DiCarava projected onto the jazz man as the sound I saw. Or alternatively, that which experimental filmmaker Arthur Jaffa has come to view as the looked-for possibility of visual intonation in Black visual culture specifically. I mean to imply, that is, these two understandings of the photographic capacity for sound at once and their instinctive recognition of an essential sonority to the being, the very idea, one might say, of photography, which I take to also approach the more general condition of spectatorship the Slovenian philosopher Slavoj Žižek has described alluringly, if still somewhat cryptically, as, quote, seeing in the mode of hearing. I mean to argue still more directly that inasmuch as the photograph, any photograph, is already always the precluded possibility of video or film, and thus also a reflection of its most elemental lack, a reflection, that is to say, of what it is willed or in itself wills not to be, photography may not be at all disabled in its condition of presentation or display to produce sound, but may be perfectly silent in any case, rather than mute, as we might otherwise assume. What I am trying to say here, as Žižek suggested so many years ago under the banner of philosophy, is this, quote, sound does not simply persist at a different level with regard to what we see. It rather points toward a gap in the field of the visible, toward the dimension of what eludes our gaze, end quote. If we dare imagine sound, then, not as not there, but there so intimately as to dwell with the picture hidden, as it were, in a perceptual blind spot, then with the slightest turn and tilt of the head, and a gaze more intent than our gallery habits of pause and promenade, we may see the silence of pictures yet, and hear with our eyes their lower frequencies amplified. If, as the great Sean Michelle Smith put it, photography is subtended by an optical unconscious, an unnerving sense of living in a world only partially perceived in vision, which recognition, she says, graduates to, quote, a revelation of an unseen world that photography does not fully disclose but makes us aware of in its invisibility. In the place of this optical unconscious, however, which which Sean Smith has so carefully parsed from Freud, Walter Benjamin, and Rosalind Krauss, I want to posit a corresponding and contrapuntal aural unconscious at photography's ground. By photography's aural, A-U-R-A-L, unconscious, I do not mean a subliminal condition inherent to the mechanical or digital processes of picture making, as if the camera possessed a psychic life apart. I mean rather a metaphorical domain where the sounds formally adhering to or otherwise called up by the photographic event before the picture of it is finally materially made are, in a manner of speaking, archived for those with ears to hear. There, in the photograph's blind spot, the aural unconscious resounds, its unseen properties reflecting only that aspect of the photographic not available to visual apprehension. Few photographic subjects teach us this as forcefully, or should I say as noisily, as Martin Luther King Jr. Regularly misrecognized and presumed to have in view, the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, a 1957 photograph, probably taken for the British Picture Post magazine, features King speaking from the same Capitol platform where he would deliver the I Have a Dream address 6 years later. The prayer pilgrimage for freedom, observing the third anniversary of the historic Brown versus Board of Education ruling, was the occasion for King's picture. The near silhouette outline of King's clerical robe has him ceremonially straddling the line, as it were, between judge and priest on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. But his facelessness, preserved by the photograph's reverse view of him, and his ample sleeves flowering with the demonstrative stretch of his arms, are an invitation to also consider an apparitional subjectivity, whose death is not so much prefigured as, for us, past. Unlike the more obscured machinations of those later canonical photographs of King standing in the very same place in 1963, this photograph does not conceal its threats, it owns them. Taken from an angle at which King could never see himself, Picture Post's image of King sounding forth, "Give us the ballot and we will," was his sonorous refrain, discloses obliquely the threat of a panoptic state power sufficient to kill him. The angle is predatory, I mean to suggest, and thus consonant with that peculiar confession of the late Susan Sontag, which we might take to first index, then warn us all of the routinely understated potentiality for a symbolic, if though no less real, violence that cameras placed in the wrong hands can affect. According to Sontag, to photograph people is to risk, quote, turning people into objects that can be symbolically possessed. Still worse, the neurotic who lifts his camera to shoot a subject commits, quote, a sublimated murder, A soft murder, she calls it, in the act of picture taking. As often as King was in the camera's eye, from those early days in Montgomery to his Memphis murder, who can doubt that this precise genre of sublimation, rife with pathos on the one hand and still yet murderously motivated on the other, did inspire many of the most widely circulated photographs of King. Caught as he so often was in the crosshairs of so many Cyclops lenses, King is already always a dead man in pictures, it seems. As much then, prior to his assassination, as now, 50 years past that ear-splitting crime. To the extent that so little has been contemplated about King's life and career in pictures per se, it is scarcely stretching things, given the auditory content of photography's ground, to posit that the fullest possibility of what King sounded like has yet to be heard or imagined, tape recordings and rhetorical analyses notwithstanding. To put this another way, and more specifically, I submit that if photographs in general bear a phonic substance constitutive of the condition of the visual broadly, then the picture of King holding forth on the National Mall in 1957, for instance, or that which witnesses to the felt sublimation of an imminent, though as yet unrealized, civil rights victory in Memphis from the nerve center of the Church of God in Christ there in 1968, reflects the very repression of sound by which photographs maintain their pretense to pure visuality. With their amplification technology and public address apparatus in plain view, we may think of these images then as meta pictures, photographs depicting nothing less than the phonic anteriority of Black voice, a negative sonority at once prior to and productive of King's visual capture on camera. More than coincidental details, the countless daises, King at Stanford, polished wood pulpits, and hard metal microphones that so commonly stage King's public life in pictures hint at this repressed remainder buried behind or somewhere very deep within the many photographs of King preaching or performing speech making. The amplification apparatus especially, so wholly naturalized into the scene of speech and performance, it passes nearly unseen, deafening the view to the very sounds helping to achieve the desired image. In other words, amplification may have augmented the tonality of King's voice in Washington and Memphis with farther-reaching reverberations than their immediate time and place, but it is also certain that that technology helped mute the constant clickings of the state threat or its mobocratic underside in cameras, recorders, timers, and triggers, and all their common sonic terror for a man resigned to die a violent death. In Memphis, on the eve of King's assassination, to take another example, the weather was foreboding. Every thunderclap and wind-blown slam crash of the hinged windows in Mason Temple Auditorium was to the increasingly edgy speechmaker a rifle discharged. Or so it seemed. Who can doubt then that holding forth from Mason Temple's In the Round pulpit, King, on the eve of his assassination, was answering back with a thunder of his own, facing the mortal threat he surely heard but could not, for the life of him, see. To have been present at Mason Temple that fateful night would have been to experience the sound of that remarkable voice in the flesh, as it were, to have been compelled by the force of it to hear and admit that the grain of it, as Roland Barthes would surely have said, is, if not something else, something out of this world, then clearly it is something more. The grain of King's voice, that something else there beyond or before words, is best heard, sensed aurally in that soaring vibrato speak of his whose pathos and authority so many black clergy, elected officials, and public intellectuals have sought and failed abysmally to replicate. King's vibrato, the play of overtone and resonance, lament and ecstasy, is the approach to a black meta voice bearing the weight of accumulated black injury, rage, and creative suffering. I've looked over and I've seen the promised land brings to near conclusion King's April 3, 1968 address at historic Mason Temple Church of God in Christ. It doesn't matter with me now, he preached, because I've been to the mountaintop and I've looked over and I seen the promised land. Testifying to terrors seen and unseen, though still yet devoted to the eschatological hope of freedom that was his consistent text, King's vibrato resounded to the rafters. If the picture of King performing preaching or speech making is, as I have said, the picture of King already always dead, each photograph bearing the shadow menace of the assassination which is to come, then even on the night prior to its deadly achievement, King speaks in Memphis as from the dead. His tremolo, I seen the promised land, a death rattle and a visitation of spirits. Oriented, therefore, toward a silence that reverberates precisely because there are no words fully fit to the non-world, the vibrato is vestibular to the perfect pitch of the terrible and the sublime that seems so impossible to represent. Simultaneously excessive and partial, King's vibrato is a bridge between the verbal visual and the substance of life beyond what we can see or dream. If photography may be looked to sound off, to reproduce not only the object of the camera's attention, that is, but the noisiness of that which no camera can ever fully see, much less reproduce, then looking at King performing preaching or speech making is at root a listening. And you have to keep looking, the poet and theorist Fred Moulton suggests, so you can listen to him. With that, I end, and I thank you for listening.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast. Thank you.